Hello and welcome to our quarterly podcast discussing activities to support consistent application. And this podcast covers the last quarter of 2021. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm here today with Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the ISB and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. So in today's podcast, we're going to cover the discussions at the November Interpretations Committee meeting, as well as decisions the ISB made in December on its lease liability in a sale and leaseback project. Now, those of you tuning in and expecting to hear about Tiltro 3 transactions on this podcast are going to be disappointed, but please tune back in next time. The committee had planned to discuss comments received on the Tiltro 3 transaction tentative agenda decision, but I'm afraid the committee's discussions on a new topic dealing with vehicle carbon emission regulation occupied all of the time we had available at the November meeting. So the committee will discuss Tiltro 3 transactions at its next meeting. So I'm going to start as ever today with finalised agenda decisions. And there was one discussed by the committee in November, and that agenda decision is actually already published. It was published in December after ISB members did not object to its publication at the December ISB meeting. So Sue, I'm going to ask you to remind listeners about this wind farm agenda decision.
Okay, so in this submission, the submitter asked a question about our leasing standard, IFRS 16, and specifically whether a particular contract to fix the price of electricity produced by a wind farm conveys the right to obtain the economic benefits from use of that wind farm, which is one part of the definition of a lease in IFRS 16. And before I get into the detail of what was discussed, it's important perhaps to point out that the committee discussed only this aspect of the question. There are other questions that might arise in accounting for the fact pattern submitted, like, for example, whether the wind farm should be consolidated by the counterparty, but the committee focused only on this very specific question on the definition of a lease. So to explain the fact pattern, picture an electricity market where all suppliers of electricity sell the electricity they produce to a market grid, and all of the purchasers of electricity buy electricity from that grid. A market operator determines the spot price for the electricity that's sold and bought on the grid. And I mentioned the structure of the market because that in turn influenced the terms and conditions of the wind farm contract that was being considered, which then determines the assessment of whether the definition of a lease is met in accordance with IFRS 16. So given that market environment, in the fact pattern discussed, an electricity retailer has entered into a contract with the wind farm to fix the price of a volume of electricity equal to the volume that the wind farm produces over a 20-year period. And the retailer and the wind farm settle net in cash the difference between the fixed price and the spot price for that volume of electricity. The contract also transfers to the retailer all renewable energy credits that accrue from the use of the wind farm, but importantly, the retailer acquires actual electricity from the grid, not from the wind farm. So on this question, the committee concluded that the contract does not contain a lease because the contract that we're considering doesn't give the retailer the right to obtain substantially all of the economic benefits from use of the wind farm. And that's because the contract gives rise to neither the right nor the obligation for the retailer to obtain any electricity that the wind farm produces. The retailer purchases its electricity from the grid. So that was the core discussion. However, in response to some feedback that we got in the comment letters, the committee also added references to two earlier agenda decisions that may be relevant to the accounting to the contract described in this wind farm agenda decision. And those agenda decisions discuss the own use scope exemption in IFRS 9 and cash flow hedge accounting requirements in IFRS 9 and IAS 39. So they're included there just as a reminder for those reading the agenda decision.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Sue. So let's now move on then to a couple of new topics that the committee discussed, and I'm going to start with IFRS 15 and the assessment of whether an entity is a principal or agent. So this is an aspect of revenue recognition that can be tricky. It very much depends on the specific facts and circumstances. It can require judgment and, of course, really matters. And it really matters because the outcome of the principal agent assessment can make a big difference to the amount of revenue and expenses an entity recognises. And the question submitted to the committee involves the transfer of intangible goods. It's actually software licenses, which of course can make the assessment all the more tricky. But maybe I'll start by summarising the facts. The entity in question here is a software reseller who has a distribution agreement with a software manufacturer to sell that manufacturer's standard software licenses. And that distribution agreement gives the reseller the right to sell those licenses and to determine the price charged to customers. And it requires the reseller to provide pre-sales advice to customers, to really give advice to customers about the types of licenses that maybe needs to order and the numbers of those licenses. Now, the licenses sold, as I said, are standard licenses. The reseller doesn't customize or modify them at all. And once the customer decides to purchase those standard software licenses, it signs a contract with the reseller, and it also separately signs a contract with the manufacturer. And it's the manufacturer who then transfers the licenses to the customer directly via a software portal and by providing an activation key. So if the customer does not accept any of the licenses, or sorry, does not accept just some amount of the licenses that might be delivered because they fail to meet its needs, then the reseller is actually liable. It can't actually return any unaccepted licenses to the manufacturer or can't sell them to anybody else. So those are the facts. So what did the committee say about how to even go about assessing whether this reseller is a principal or agent?
Well, the first thing the committee did was point out what the applicable requirements are, and they sit within the application guidance in IFRS 15. Paragraphs B34 to B38 set out a framework and the requirements for an entity to apply in assessing whether it's a principal or an agent for the purposes of the standard. And that assessment is basically all about control. So it's determining whether the entity is a principal or an agent. The reseller needs to assess whether it obtains control of the software licenses before those licenses are transferred to the customer. Now, in the fact pattern submitted, the committee concluded that the only promised goods in the contract with the customer are the standard software licenses. And so the principal versus agent assessment focuses on whether the reseller obtains control of those licenses before they're transferred to the customer. However, if there were other promised goods or services in the contract, then the reseller would first need to identify each distinct good or service or distinct bundle of goods or services and assess the control of each of those. Now, the committee noted that the reseller would apply judgment to make its overall assessment of whether it obtains control of the software licenses. And if, after applying the requirements on control in IFRS 15, it's unclear whether the reseller is a principal or an agent, the reseller must consider the indicators that are set out in paragraph B37 of IFRS 15 in order to make that control assessment. So they're mandatory indicators in that situation. The committee also importantly highlighted relevant disclosure requirements, including material accounting policy information that's required in the recent amendments to IAS 1.
Okay, now I have a couple of questions on this one, and this is an area actually of IFRS 15 that really I just can't help myself because I worked on this part of the ISB's clarifications project on the principal or agent requirements, so I always find it really interesting. So my first question is that I think if anybody had the opportunity or wants to read the paper and look at the submission itself, I think the submitter itself seemed to be saying that this pre-sales advice, that the submitter viewed that as promised consulting. And then the submitter was really saying, look, as the reseller, aren't they providing a combined package of consulting and licenses to the customer? And shouldn't the assessment be looking at that combined package of consulting and licenses? But I think, Sue, you're saying the committee disagreed with that.
Yes, they did. So the terms and conditions of the reseller's contract with the customer identified only the transfer of the standard software licenses as an explicit promise to the customer. And the committee concluded that the pre-sales advice was not an implicit promise in the contract. At the time of entering the actual contract with the customer, the resellers already provided that advice, and there was no further advice to be provided or transferred to the customer after the inception of the contract. So the committee concluded that the only promised goods in the contract were with the customer were the software licenses themselves. And there are requirements in paragraph 24 of IFRS 15 that address how to identify the promises in a contract with a customer.
Great, thank you, Sue. And I think what's really interesting there is obviously we started by saying the principal or agent requirements are in the application guidance. But I think what's really important is if you look at those requirements, they send you to other parts of IFRS 15 as well. And first of all, you've got to identify what those promised goods or services are. Okay, my last question then, which is, we did talk about the promises in the contract, but I think neither the staff in the paper nor the committee in the tentative agenda decision have actually concluded on whether the reseller is a principal or an agent. And I was wondering, could you explain why?
And that's a good question, because I think it's sometimes difficult for people reading these tentative agenda decisions or indeed final agenda decisions to understand why sometimes the committee reaches conclusions and in other cases it doesn't. So for this question, if you read the tentative agenda decision, you'll see, first of all, that the committee points to the applicable requirements and it sets out the steps an entity needs to take to apply those requirements. It also then does reach some conclusions about what the promised goods or services are in the reseller's contract with the customer, which we've talked about already. But as you note, the committee doesn't go on to conclude on whether the reseller is a principal or an agent with respect to the software licenses that are transferred to the customer. And that's because the conclusion really requires the use of judgment, and it really requires consideration of all the terms and conditions of relevant contracts, including those between the reseller and the customer, the manufacturer and the reseller, and the manufacturer and the customer. And you have to look at it holistically. So the committee really is trying to help stakeholders obtain a common understanding of how to read and apply the principles and requirements in the standards. And the committee often does this and did it in this case by highlighting the requirements that apply and, based on those requirements, setting out what questions an entity needs to ask itself and form opinions on or assessments of in order to reach its conclusion. So the committee didn't want to remove or replace the judgment that an entity needs to make to determine the required accounting for the transaction. So I think in this case, the committee has been helpful in setting out what entities need to read and what they how to apply the requirements, but it hasn't said this is the answer. And I think it's really important because a subtle difference in a fact pattern, one that wasn't mentioned in the outline in the tentative agenda decision, might really matter in the balance of that assessment. So I think it's both more appropriate and more useful for the committee to point out what to think about, what assessment needs to be made, rather than saying in this fact pattern, this is the answer.
Great, thank you, Sue. Important. So that tentative agenda decision on the principal or agent requirements is now out for comment. And of course, we would, as ever, welcome your comments. And the comment period ends on the 8th of February. So I'm going to move on now to IS 37. Again, the second new question we discussed, and it's a question on whether and when an entity has an obligation under regulations enacted to encourage entities to import and produce more energy efficient vehicles and actually thereby reduce the number of vehicles imported and produced that are not so good for the environment. Now, I imagine that most IFRS preparers are now aware that climate and sustainability, of course, are not things coming some years down the road. They actually matter now. And this question is really a great example of how and why climate-related matters already affect the preparation of financial statements applying IFRS accounting standards. So in this case, what's the fact pattern? Well, the question is about regulation introduced in a particular jurisdiction that affects the import and production of passenger vehicles in that jurisdiction. So all importers and producers of these vehicles must sign up to the regulation. Entities receive negative credits if they import or produce vehicles whose emission levels exceed targets set by the government, and the regulation requires an entity to eliminate its net negative credits. It can do that in two different ways. It can either purchase positive credits to eliminate those negative credits, or it can generate its own positive credits in the future that it can use then to eliminate negative credits. And if an entity fails to eliminate those negative credits via either of those two routes, the government may then impose economic sanctions on the entity. So what a submitter asked was whether an entity that has generated negative credits, does it have a present obligation that meets the definition of a liability in IAS 37? Now, on this topic, the committee really did have a great discussion. And again, I would encourage you to go listen to that if you have the time. And it really discussed, you know, went into some depth in discussing how to go about reading and applying the different aspects of the definition of a liability in IAS 37. Now, what that definition says is a liability is a present obligation of an entity that arises from past events, the settlement of which is expected to result in an outflow of resources embodying economic benefits. Now, IAS 37 also says that that past event within the definition is an obligating event, which IAS 37 defines as a legal or constructive obligation where the entity has no realistic alternative to settling that obligation. Now, one reason why this question about this regulation is so fascinating is because analysing it and assessing whether there is an obligation really touches on all of those aspects of the definitions in IAS 37 that I've just emphasised. Now, the committee's discussion here led to the conclusion that an entity that has generated negative credits has a present obligation that meets the definition of liability, unless accepting the economic sanctions is a realistic alternative for the entity to settling the obligation. And that's because the obligation arises on importing or producing the vehicles that exceed the targets. So the committee voted not to add a standard setting project to the work plan, but the committee decided that to ensure the tentative agenda decision is as clear and helpful as possible, that it would really benefit from further discussing the wording of the tentative agenda decision, which it'll do at its next meeting. So I'm not going to talk further about this question now. For all of you as interested, by the way, in this topic as I am, then please listen in to the next podcast for more details on it. And we'll cover the committee's, you know, further discussions on the wording of the tentative agenda decision in the next podcast. So finally, moving back, I suppose, to IFRS 16, but onto a new topic, which is to give you an update on the ISB's narrow scope project on lease liabilities that arise in a sale and leaseback transaction. And the reason we're talking about this is that the ISB reached decisions on this project at its December meeting, having considered the feedback received on the related exposure draft. So a quick reminder of what this project is all about. First of all, the project arose really, it started from a question to the committee on sale and leaseback transactions with variable payments. And that question really identified, I suppose, what I'll call a gap in the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16. And that's because those sale and leaseback requirements, they tell a seller lessee what to do at the date of the transaction, tells it how to measure the right of use asset, how to measure the gain in the transaction, and consequently how to measure the liability arising at the date of the transaction. But those requirements don't say anything about how to subsequently measure the liability that arises. Now, when the leaseback payments are payments that fit within the definition of lease payments in IFRS 16, so for example, if they're fixed payments or if there's payments based on an index or rate, then entities could apply the subsequent measure requirements in IFRS 16, really as they do for other leases. But the question that arose was really, how do you subsequently measure that lease liability that arises when the leaseback payments include variable payments, say linked to future performance or use of the lease leased asset that are not included in the measurement of lease liabilities for standalone leases. Now, why even did this question arise? And I suppose it hits at the fact that the sale and leaseback model in IFRS 16, very much designed to reflect the economics of a sale and leaseback transaction, could result in the lease liability that arises in that sale and leaseback transaction being measured to reflect variable payments linked to future performance or use of the leased asset. So there is kind of a tension between the simplified measurement we have for leases and the specific treatment of sale and leasebacks, which restrict the gains or losses recognised. So in the exposure draft, the ISB proposed to fill that sort of missing piece in the sale and leaseback requirements by specifying that the lease liability arising in a sale and leaseback would be measured at the present value of expected lease payments, which would include expected variable payments linked to future performance or use of the leased asset. Now, feedback in those proposals was very mixed, although many agreed that it makes sense to retain the partial gain model in IFRS 16 for sale and leaseback transactions. Many had conceptual and practical concerns about requiring the leaseback liability to be measured at the present value of expected lease payments. So, Sue, having considered that feedback, what did the ISB decide in December?
Well, so this project has turned out to be a bit of a tricky one for the ISB. So as Petrina said, IFRS 16's got two sort of slightly different measurement models. One for what we've referred to as standalone leases, so leases unrelated to sale and leaseback transactions. And for those leases, variable payments linked to future performance or use of the leased asset aren't included in the measurement of the lease liability, in part because it's just simpler. The other model that was developed specifically for sale and leaseback transactions is a more economic model. So when the leaseback payments include variable payments linked to future performance or use of the leased asset, the sale and leaseback requirements would result in the seller lessee recognising a lease liability that includes lease payments, even if they're fully variable based on, say, turnover, in order to get that restricted gain that we've referred to earlier. So the ISB had developed the exposure draft with proposals as a narrow scope amendment. So in a way that would have retained the existing sale and leaseback requirements and proposed no change to the requirements for any other leases. And although many supported us not reconsidering the existing requirements, the feedback received did tell us that stakeholders were uncomfortable with us being very specific about exactly how to measure the lease liability. And especially because we proposed requiring the inclusion of all expected payments, including variable payments that wouldn't be included in the measurement of a standalone lease, in the measurement. Some, I think, you know, were concerned that this might be a first step towards including all variable payments in all lease liabilities, including standalone leases. And also, I think many were, you know, legitimately asked how big a change we should really be making to a standard before the post-implementation review. So in December, the board focused on the objective of the project, what we were really trying to achieve, and reached decisions that would remove some of the specificity while still meeting the objective. So we decided that the final amendments would not require one particular way of subsequently measuring the lease liability arising in a sale and leaseback, but instead the amendments would place limits or parameters around the accounting that a seller, a lessee, could apply within those parameters. So the seller lessee could choose a method within sort of bounds, if you like, as long as it was applied consistently. And the two main limits or parameters set are that firstly, a seller lessee should apply the subsequent measurement requirements in IFRS 16. So the, in particular, interest on the lease back liability must be recognised over the lease term. And secondly, the seller lessee has to apply a method to amortising the liability that ensures that there's no recognition of a gain or loss on the right of use asset that's retained in the sale and leaseback. So you have to have this partial gain recognition preserved.
Great. So I think, so you're basically saying we're going to pull back in terms of the degree of detail in the amendments to really deal with the most pressing aspects of what we were trying to achieve, but without being more prescriptive.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. I'd say we're trying to be pragmatic, do as little as possible to make sure people know what to do and to stick with the core requirements in IFRS 16.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Sue, for that. We started this podcast and ended with IFRS 16. Personally, I view that as a good podcast. So that will now bring our podcast to a close. Thank you as ever, Sue, for joining me today. And thank you all for listening. Please email communications@ifrs.org if you have suggestions for improvement. So please take care. Thank you and goodbye.